thank you very much indeed for the invitation. It's wonderful to be here. Just to explain what this is about, because you're bound to be wondering all the way through otherwise, and actually I've torn the muscle in my shoulder doing some ill-advised DIY, I'm afraid, so that's the reason for that. So I'm sort of one-handed at the moment. Fortunately, a parishioner of mine's brought me today, and he's going to take me home again later, so that's worked out quite well, in fact. It's also necessary, I think, for me to explain why it is I'm giving this talk about the Titanic disaster. I'm not a Titanic buff or expert. These people do exist. You know, people who know everything there possibly is to know about the ship down to the last rivet, and everything about the whole timeline of the disaster and down to the finest pernickety detail. Well, that's not me. My interest in this comes from quite a different source. Back in 1997, I was chaplain and teaching RE in a big suburban church secondary school in West London. And I was looking to teach a module on the Sacrament of Reconciliation with my year nine. A more dismal prospect cannot be contemplated. So I was feeling rather sort of down in the dumps about that and struggling very hard to come up with an idea that would engage them, a hook on which things could be hung, when I started to be stopped in the corridor, particularly by year nine girls, saying to me, "Have you seen the film Titanic?" Because it was, of course, the year that the James Cameron blockbuster Titanic came out. And they were particularly excited to tell me about this because they said, "There's a priest in it who hears confessions as the priest goes, as the ship goes down." And of course, they were very excited to tell me this because, of course, I wouldn't go to the cinema and watch a film unless there was a priest in it, of course. But it actually gave me the idea of how to approach this module. So I bought lots of fanzine magazines of Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet and plastered them all over my whiteboard. And then we talked about the disaster and the role that this priest had played in the film. And it was just a way in. They were all mad for the film and everything about it at the time, so it was a really effective way of getting into talking about reconciliation. But it sparked a thought in my own mind. Was this priest in the film a real historical person, or was he simply included for effect, just as there are always in airline disaster movies two nuns on the aeroplane? I don't know whether you've noticed that, but as if the church keeps them in the air all the time just in case there might be a disaster. But it turned out that no, he was a real person, and not only that, but he was from the school where I was teaching was in London. Turned out that he was a priest of the Diocese of Westminster, and that he'd been based only a little way down the road from me at one time. So my interest was sparked and I went to the diocesan archivist of the Diocese of Westminster, and with some digging, there he was. Back at the time of the disaster, there was a lot of coverage in the Catholic press, though he'd been over the years forgotten about. So it's a case of resurrecting an old story in that way, and it's that this talk is about. At 20 minutes to midnight on Sunday the 14th of April 1912, the luxury White Star liner RMS Titanic, on her maiden voyage from Southampton to New York, struck an iceberg in mid-North Atlantic, 400 miles off the coast of Newfoundland. The impact of the collision was, in fact, relatively slight, going unnoticed by many on board, but the damage caused to the vessel would prove fatal. Although there was on the ocean at the time a flat calm, the immense forces exerted by the water entering the ship's hull caused her violently to rend apart. In just 2 hours and 40 minutes, the 46,000-ton ship claimed to have been unsinkable broke into and plunged to the ocean floor, causing over 1,500 of her passengers and crew to perish in the freezing water. There can be very few people alive in the world today who have not heard of the Titanic disaster. And yet, it's true to say that the lives and the identities of many of those who were themselves caught up in that historic event have remained unknown. And this is the story of one such individual, Father Thomas R.D. Biles, a Roman Catholic priest, pastor of St. Helens, Ongar, who acted with great heroism on that fateful night and was himself a victim of the disaster. Father Biles has been depicted more than once in film and television, where he's been depicted variably as either Irish or American. But he was neither. He was an Englishman, and he was not brought up as a Roman Catholic. He was born Russell David Biles on the 26th of February 1870, the eldest of seven children to the Reverend Dr. Alfred Holden Biles, a Congregationalist minister, and his wife Louisa Davids. There's the Reverend Holden Biles, Louisa Davids, and this is the young Russell Biles there. The place of Father Biles' birth is not known for certain, but it was probably Leeds, West Yorkshire, where his father was minister of the Headingley Hill Congregationalist Church. As I think there's some indication of in this photograph, the young Russell was a sickly child. He was not a well child. It's thought probably, although it was never diagnosed, had epilepsy, which was then not a well understood disease, and he suffered regular fits, which understandably made him rather awkward and self-conscious. He found the company of other children difficult, and maybe it was this, in part, one supposes, that meant that he spent much of his time in reading. We're told that from his earliest childhood, he was remarkable for his love of books. And early on, he was recognised as being a very gifted student. At 8 years of age, he was sent to Leeds Grammar School, where he gained his first scholarship. People think that a lot of pressure is put on children today, academically, a scholarship at age 8. Then at 12, he went on to Leamington College, his father having moved to a new posting there. At Leamington, we're told, and I quote, that he distinguished himself in mathematics and held a scholarship for 1 year, besides gaining numerous prizes. From Leamington, at the age of 15, Russell Biles won what was then considered to be one of the best public school scholarships to Rossall, Fleetwood, in Lancashire, a Church of England school regarded to be one of the very best in the country. As you can perhaps see, by the look of this rather formidable clergyman, Russell School was High Church Anglican. And although he'd been brought up as a Congregationalist, Russell soon became himself a High Church Anglican. He was confirmed in the Church of England and daily attended services in the chapel, which is there, collegiate style, having, we're told, a particular devotion to the Eucharist, to Holy Communion. He also continued to excel at his studies, and especially at mathematics. And so it was no surprise to anyone when at 19 years old he won a scholarship to Oxford. Anyone recognise that college? Balliol, indeed. Went up to Balliol College to study towards a degree as a mathematician. Now, Balliol had something of a reputation at the time, a reputation for mathematics, indeed, as it still has, but also a reputation for being liberal and free thinking. Oxford was, of course, a rather more staid sort of place than it is now. There was, shock horror, a relaxed atmosphere at Balliol, and students were encouraged to debate, to argue with their masters. Unthinkable. Well, this suited the young Russell down to the ground, who would later be criticised for his, quote, independence of character, which a friend wrote after his death was, I quote, sometimes strained into too great self-confidence, his clear and strong convictions leaving little patience for those who differed. He was argumentative to a T. He was known for being irascible, testy, for not suffering fools gladly. But at Oxford, Russell's spiritual searchings came to rather get in the way of his academic career. He did surprisingly poorly in his exams and decided to change subject to modern history. But this turned out not to be what he was looking for either. And eventually it came to him that he had a vocation to be a priest in the Church of England. And so he decided to stay on at the university, but in order to train for ordination. Then, however, something else happened. There was in the air at the time in the Church of England, as I'm sure you're aware, a lot of debate about ecclesiastical matters, especially regarding the whole question as to whether or not the Church of England could claim to be part of the wider Catholic family of churches. And some very notable Anglican high churchmen, including, of course, a very famous man you heard about this morning, Newman, had come to feel that their true home was not in the Church of England, but in the Roman Catholic Church, and had left in order to become Roman Catholics. And there's a contemporary satirical cartoon lampooning the High Church Anglicans as walking on thin ice there. Yes. Well, Russell Biles came to feel much the same way. And shortly before he was due to be ordained in the Church of England as a deacon, he left the Church of England for the Roman Catholic Church at his reception, taking the name of Thomas. It was at the time of the Feast of Corpus Christi, and he chose the name Thomas in honour of St. Thomas Aquinas. Well, the Roman Catholic Church didn't initially know what to do with this new convert. He was a very odd fish, shall we say. Although he was a Roman Catholic, he was still at Oxford University, which was something that in itself was, well, not just frowned upon, one needed a dispensation to be in the establishment at the time. The university, of course, was then still very much an Anglican establishment institution. But not only that, not only was he studying at Oxford, but he was actually still studying towards ordination in the Church of England. It's been said, probably accurately, that Russell Byles was the only person ever to have sat the exam for entry into the Church of England ministry whilst actually being a Roman Catholic.
What sort of day is it?
That's a very good question. You'll have to ask me that again at the end. It would have been towards the end of the 19th century, certainly. Yes, I think it would have been. Yes, I think it would have been. I can look that up. After his graduation in theology, of course, he didn't go on to be ordained. Instead, he spent some time travelling on the continent, during which time he became, for a brief spell, tutor to a German prince, as you do. On his return, though, he was accepted as a candidate for ordination to the Roman Catholic priesthood by Cardinal Vaughan, Archbishop of Westminster, and he entered seminary at St. Mary's College, Oscott. Here's Oscott. But, for reasons that aren't entirely certain, things did not work out. Probably for reasons connected with his health. He left seminary and he taught for a while at St. Edmund's, where, before again leaving and spending time travelling abroad. But, with typical tenacity, if not to say awkwardness, he still persisted in his conviction that he had a vocation. And eventually, after some more traumas and stops and starts and a great deal of reluctance on the part of the hierarchy, he was sent to the Bader College in Rome to study for the Roman Catholic priesthood at age 32. Being ordained a Roman Catholic priest. And that's his ordination photo there. He came back to England, but ill health still plagued him. His fits continued, and although he really only had one ambition, and that was to be a parish priest, he was deemed unsuitable for parish ministry. I've seen the file card that's still in the diocesan offices in Westminster, and there are the words unsuitable for parish ministry. For a while, he was given a teaching post again at St. Edmund's Ware, and then he came to be attached to the newly founded Catholic Missionary Society. He's in fact regarded to be one of the founding fathers of what was CMS, of course no more. Although it seems that his ill health prevented him from playing a full part, so he seems to have exercised a supportive and advisory role only. It seems that ill health too next caused him to be sent up north to the Leeds diocese for a time, to St. Joseph's Mission, Barnoldswick, presumably to convalesce, after which he was sent to Essex to the Holy Archangels Caldon, Colchester, apparently awaiting the decision of the cardinal what to do with him. He's once again having become a problem to be solved. Finally, though, the cardinal seems to have relented, and Father Byles was appointed to a parish, although that's probably the wrong term to use, as far as the history of things is concerned, to a church. St. Helens Ongar has a priest missioner with a tiny, tiny church. That's the church there. But with an absolutely huge mission district that was composed mostly of Irish labourers employed to work on the new Eastern Counties Railway. In the parish history there, Father Byles is remembered as being very well loved. He was respected, of course, as you'd expect, for being highly intelligent and as a good preacher, but he was also remembered as being an exceptionally caring pastor, even given the vast gulf of experience between him and the people to whom he was ministering. And this devotion to the people led him into some very unlikely pursuits. As a colleague wrote of him, and I quote, "He was known to be a learned man, a good preacher, and a caring pastor to his people. A number of Ongar boys, wishing to learn boxing, were taught by Father Byles, the instruction taking place in a shed behind the church." Imagine what the safeguarding officer would make of that these days. Many other stories could be told that are in the parish history in Ongar there, but it was at this point in time that Father Byles was to keep his appointment with Titanic and with destiny. Father Byles' brother, William, had also become a Roman Catholic, and he'd gone to America, as young men did in those days, to seek his fortune. And he'd met and fallen in love with an American girl. And things having taken their natural course, they became engaged and were preparing to be married. And they invited Father Byles to celebrate the nuptial mass. It was the people at St. Helens who raised the money for a ticket for an ocean liner so that Father Byles could make the voyage across. It cost about £13, which was a king's ransom in those days. Just imagine the wages that the navvies must have been on. There, quite an achievement. Ironically, it wasn't Titanic on which he was booked to travel. It was expected that Titanic's maiden voyage would be sold out, so they made no effort to try and book a ticket. But a coal strike delayed things. Businessmen and others who had deadlines to meet in New York therefore transferred to other ships and places became available. And it was only because of that that Father Byles ended up sailing on Titanic. Titanic was due to sail at midday on the Wednesday of Easter week, the 10th of April 1912, and was expected to arrive in New York a week later on Wednesday the 17th, which was fast. A week crossing was fast in those days. And this is actually, it's a hand-tinted black and white photograph, but it is actually of Titanic at berth in Southampton, probably just after boarding, I'd have thought. On the morning of its departure, Father Byles took the railway to London and at Waterloo Station joined the boat train for Southampton. The formalities of boarding completed, arrangement was made with the ship's commander, Captain Edward J. Smith, for the use of a space on board ship in which to offer daily mass. Father Biles having taken with him a rather ingenious portable altar, loaned by a priest friend of his who'd been a military chaplain. Titanic departed Southampton for Cherbourg, and then on to Southern Ireland, to Queenstown, Cove, where a stop was made the following morning. A handful of passengers disembarked, and over 100 immigrants, bound, as they thought, for a new life in America, joined the ship, ferried out by tenders, together with over 1,000 sacks of mail. Titanic was the Royal Mail Ship, Titanic. Then at 1:30 p.m, Titanic weighed anchor and slipped out of sight of land for New York. The remainder of Thursday, together with Friday and Saturday, were uneventful days at sea. We learn from the witness of one survivor that Father Biles was observed in the company of a fellow priest in the library. We know that there were two other priests on board the ship, one a Bavarian Benedictine on his way to Collegeville Abbey in Minnesota, and a Ukrainian Uniat priest on his way to serve the increasingly large Ukrainian community in the United States. So he was observed in the company of one of these other priests in the library, which was one of the very few distractions available to people sailing in second class. So no Turkish bath or exercise gym or anything like that for anyone other than the first class passengers. And there is the second class library where Father Biles was seen. He was, throughout these days, and this is a very important factor in the story, in regular contact with passengers in steerage in third class, through celebrating mass for them every day, but also by befriending them and being a pastor to them. It's very important to remember that, in the words of a recent writer, and I quote, "Titanic, for all its reputation for opulence, was both economically and officially an immigrant ship. And among the passengers of third class, who outnumbered those in both first and second class combined, were many who, in the terms of today, would be classed as refugees from the poorer countries of Europe and beyond. Of course, many predominantly Roman Catholic countries. And so it was no doubt to very many of them considerable comfort to have the presence of priests in the midst of all the uncertainties of the journey that they were involved in making. On the morning of Sunday, April the 14th, Father Biles offered Mass for what would be the last time. This isn't him, but it's a photograph that's almost contemporary, and it does give an idea of what Mass would have been like on board ship. It was Low Sunday, Sunday after Easter. Mass was celebrated for second-class passengers in their lounge, and later for third-class passengers down in steerage. At the two Masses, Father Biles preached a sermon both in English and in French. He could have had no idea of the pertinence of his choice of subject, being on the need of the lifeboat of religious consolation in the event of spiritual shipwreck. Not the snappiest of titles, but surprisingly prescient. for the passengers on board Titanic the afternoon and evening of that Sunday were as untroubled and uneventful as had been the previous few days sailing. The weather was bright and clear, unusually warm, in fact. Although, as the day wore on, a noticeable chill descended, driving passengers from the decks to seek the greater comfort of indoors. Unknown to the majority of them, this fall in temperature coincided with the receipt by the ship's wireless room of a series of ice warnings from other vessels, indicating the presence of a very large ice field within the ship's projected course. As a precaution, her captain ordered a special watch to be kept for ice. The ship, however, continued to speed onwards. The captain, confident in the knowledge awarded by many years' experience that any disaster could be safely averted by swift, evasive action. We don't know the whereabouts of Father Byles when the collision occurred, although given the time of night, it's reasonable to suppose that he was in bed. We don't know whether he was among those who felt the impact of the collision, or how it was he received the captain's instruction, which was passed by word of mouth throughout the ship, all passengers on deck with life belts on. Remember, there was no PA system. There was no lifeboat drill. There were no real emergency procedures of any kind. At first, the danger was far from being apparent. And the crew actually had the greatest difficulty persuading passengers into the lifeboats. The great ship seemed a far safer place to be than a tiny lifeboat lost in the middle of the freezing ocean. The first snapshot that we get of Father Byles during the disaster is at this stage, when he was seen on deck, minding his own business, taking advantage of having been woken up in the middle of the night to say his divine office. But the seriousness of the situation did begin to become apparent. And as soon as it did, we then see Father Byles proceeding to assist in persuading the women and children about him to enter the lifeboats. And as well as joining in lending physical assistance, it's recorded that Father Byles also gave spiritual consolation to the many first and second class passengers on the boat deck at that time. This is a rather sanitized illustration from a contemporary magazine. This is the witness of a survivor. I quote, "After the real danger was apparent, Father Byles went among the passengers, hearing the confessions of some and giving absolution. His immediate task having been accomplished, Father Byles' thoughts turned next to the many passengers from third class who still remained below decks. For although by now a great crowd of people were milling anxiously about on the boat deck, there were among them very few passengers from steerage." Which Father Byles was in an almost unique position to understand. He, among the passengers, alone, had had permission from the captain to move about the ship unhindered. And during the week, saying mass and being a pastor for the passengers on board, he had got to know his way around the vessel. And so he could understand now the danger that people from third class were in, because the journey from third class to the upper decks was not easy, which from the experience of the past few days he knew very well. The third class berths were located in the least desirable areas of the ship, where access even to the facilities provided for steerage were difficult from those areas. Barriers, often in the form of locked iron gates, marked the many divisions between steerage and first and second class, as American immigration law required. And ordinarily, among the areas to which no access was allowed was included, can you guess? The boat deck, where the lifeboats were. So now, in order to find their way to the boat deck, passengers from third class who were cast out of their bunks with little comprehensible explanation of what was going on, many of them unable to speak English, half-dressed, trying to gather up their frightened children, would have somehow to negotiate their way to safety through a bewildering labyrinth of gangways and stairs, some routes, regardless of the extremity of the situation, remaining barred to them. And this gives some idea, a cutaway, of the journey that would have to be made to the boat deck up here from the corridors of third class. Being in a privileged position to appreciate the perilous nature of the circumstances facing the many hundreds of third class passengers below decks, Father Biles descended to steerage in order to assist with the task of leading people there up to the lifeboats. And this again is the witness of a survivor. I quote, "When the crash came, we were thrown from our berths. Slightly dressed, we prepared to find out what had happened. We saw before us, coming down the passageway, with his hand uplifted, Father Barnes. We knew him because he had visited us several times on board and celebrated Mass for us that very morning. Well, having gathered together the women and children, Father Biles proceeded to lead them in crocodile fashion through the ship, making the convoluted journey to the boat deck." Again, the witness of a survivor. "Helping the women and children, Father Biles whispered to them words of comfort and encouragement." And this assurance was undoubtedly by now very welcome, because by now the bow of the ship was well down in the water and people were finding it hard to keep their balance. Signs of panic were beginning to appear. With a large number of women and children in tow, Father Biles reappeared on the boat deck and began loading people into the lifeboats. In the midst of all this excitement and disorder, Father Biles was encouraged to accept for himself the offer of a place on the boats, which he declined. Again, the witness of a survivor. One sailor warned the priest of his danger and begged him to board a boat. Father Biles refused. The same seaman spoke to him again, and he seemed anxious to help him, but he refused again. Father Biles could have been saved, but he would not leave while one was left, and the sailor's entreaties were not heeded. All the lifeboats were now gone. There were, of course, notoriously not enough for everyone to make their escape, and some 1,500 people were left behind. Father Biles was last seen leading a group in prayer on the second cabin deck of Titanic when she sank. Again, the witness of a survivor. I quote, "After I got in the boat, which was the last one to leave, and we were slowly going further away from the ship, I could hear distinctly the voice of the priest and the responses to his prayers. Then they became fainter and fainter, until I could only hear the strains of "Nearer, my God, to thee," and the screams of the people left behind. It would have been undoubtedly a very frightening spectacle. The process of Titanic's final foundering was immensely violent, and for those on board her, terrifying in the extreme, as is made apparent in the witness of survivor Jack Thayer, who washed off the deck, observed the final moments of the ship from the water. These are his words. "The water was over the base of the first funnel," he says. "The mass of people on board were surging back, always back towards the floating stern. The rumble and roar continued, with even louder distinct wrenchings and tearings of boilers and engines from their beds. Suddenly, the whole superstructure of the ship appeared to split well forward to midship and bow or buckle upwards. The second funnel, large enough for two automobiles to pass through abreast, seemed to be lifted off, emitting a cloud of sparks. Her deck was turned slightly toward us. We could see groups of the almost 1,500 people aboard, clinging in clusters or bunches like swarming bees, only to fall in masses, pairs or singly, as the great part of the ship, 250 feet of it, rose into the sky, till it reached a 65 or 70 degree angle. Here it seemed to pause and just hung for what felt like minutes. Gradually she turned her deck away from us, as though to hide from our sight the awful spectacle. Then, with the deadened noise of the bursting of her last few gallant bulkheads, she slid quietly away from us into the sea." Another survivor tells of how, and I quote, "Father Baugh stayed with the people after the last boat had gone, and a big crowd, 100 maybe, knelt about him. They were Catholics, Protestants, and Jewish people who were there. Father Baugh told them to prepare to meet God, and he said the rosary. The others answered him. Father Baugh was still standing there praying when the water came over the deck." Father Baugh's body was never found, so there could be no gravestone. But there is this memorial to him at the college where he once taught, at St. Edmund's Ware. "Pray for the soul of Reverend Thomas Russell David Baugh, formerly student and professor of this college, who, having embarked for New York on the ship Titanic, when that vessel struck an iceberg and became a sudden wreck, in the midst of that midnight horror of April the 14th, 1912, he twice refused the offered safety of a lifeboat, choosing rather to comfort the Catholics and other Christians with the supreme consolation of the faith, and so to die with them, too numerous to be saved from the deep, but not to escape eternal loss. Thus did he follow in the footsteps of the Good Shepherd. Thus did he lay down his life for the sheep." The wonderful use of that quotation from St. Matthew's Gospel, the words of St. Peter, "Bid me come to thee upon the waters." He was a very unlikely hero. He was small of stature, he was sickly, he was temperamental, he was argumentative, he was irascible. And yet I think this just makes his heroism all the greater. His brother's wedding went ahead, not quite as planned, in a more muted way, the simple wedding service being followed by a requiem mass. The honeymoon, though, was taken in Europe, and in Rome, the couple were granted a personal audience with the Pope, Pope St. Pius X, who expressed his belief that Father Biles had been a true martyr for charity. Very fitting tribute to one who willingly laid down his life for others. Thank you very much.